All right.
We'll bring the meeting to order. First off, we have some referrals. House File 1067 is being referred to the Mental Health Division. That's the Governor's Mental Health Initiative. And House File 1189 is being referred to the Licensing Subcommittee, which is the physical therapist bill. So, okay. And then Representative Murphy, would you move the minutes from the February 15th meeting? Any questions, members? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed to their adoption? No. The minutes are adopted. Representative Peterson, House File 250, and I will move House File 250 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the finance. Is there money in here? Is there money, Finance Committee? There's no money?
Mr. Chair and committee, I think it's a reallocation. I don't know if it's actually new money.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
So we'll just move this. Does this have to go anywhere else that you are aware of?
I'm not aware of that. Up to you.
Representative Brock.
Well, Mr. Chairman, whether it's new money or old money, it's all taxpayer money. I'm wondering why dollars, even if they might not be new dollars, would not need to go through finance.
Yeah, Well, why don't we go ahead with the bill, and then we'll figure that out. Let me look through the bill one more time. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. A couple testifiers here today, but this bill is an attempt to address shortages being experienced in rural Minnesota of trained volunteer ambulance personnel. Mary Hedges is here, and she can identify herself, and Buck McAlpin is here as well. There's three sections to the bill. In section one, you'll see eliminating the temporary variance, so eliminate temporary and make the variance, for those, basically until the license needs to be renewed by the ambulance service. And then section two, it deals with interfacility transfers, and this interfacility transfer subdivision two of section two identifies what types of places in Minnesota we're talking about. In rural Minnesota, it says there in the paragraph, outside the metro area, as defined outside Duluth, Mankato, Moorhead, Rochester, St. Cloud, or an ambulance service based in a community with a population less than 1,000, may substitute one AMT with a registered first responder. Okay, so that's the main part. And then section three is the training repayment increase. And I'll let Mary Hedges and Mr. McAlpin describe why the bill is needed and why we're in front of your committee.
Go ahead. Thanks.
Thank you.
Ms. Hedges, sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hedges. I'm the Executive Director of the state's Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, and we're the state agency that licenses all EMS personnel and licenses the ambulance services in the state. In Minnesota, we still have quite a few volunteer ambulance services, primarily in greater Minnesota. And this bill, the other thing our agency does is, in addition to regulating the ambulance service, we also support a variety of grant programs to help keep up our predominantly rural volunteer ambulance services. And I'll start with the first item. The first item is just it's a provision where currently we have a minimum requirement of two emergency medical technicians on every ambulance call. And we're saying in this provision we will make an exception for a rural struggling ambulance service with a hardship to allow them to apply for a variance which will allow them to substitute one of the higher trained EMTs with a first responder for a 2-year period, and they can renew that. So it's an attempt to address the staffing shortages of the rural volunteer EMTs. The second provision of the bill is very similar, but it applies to a lot of times when ambulance services are asked to take a patient from a small hospital in greater Minnesota to a larger city hospital. That can involve, a 3 to 4 hour round trip. It can be a, 5 hour transport time. And what we're saying is, in those cases, they can substitute the first responder for one of the two required EMTs on those long-distance transports. Again, it's to make sure they have enough EMTs back at home to cover any 911 calls they get. The third provision is just, that pertains to one of our grant programs that we have to support EMS. And it's every year we're appropriated, I think it's $385,000 to reimburse for training, reimbursing ambulance services for training the volunteers to become EMTs, and every 2 years to renew their EMT license. That amount has been set in statute, $425 for the initial course and $475 the initial course and $225 the refresher, and it hasn't gone up in 13 years. And the courses, the cost of the training keeps going up. Typically, any money, we always have some money left over that ends up being distributed to some of the regional EMS programs per statute. What the folks thought, even including the people that got the leftover money, was that it really should go to support the increased training fees of these volunteers. So we're proposing to raise the training fee, and we base it on the number of requests we get usually per year, and this seems to be about right to increase the training reimbursement to $600 for the initial course. The average course is about $1,000, and I believe it's $275 for the refresher.
Mr. McAlpin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Last year, the Ambulance Association, along with the fire chiefs, of some legislation passed last year, formed a task force, a recruitment and retention task force, to travel about Minnesota and have a report prepared for Commissioner Campion on December 15th. We did do that and made some recommendations off that. One thing that we did find is we knew we were in near crisis in most of rural Minnesota with some ambulance staffing, but we were surprised to hear that at certain times during the day, we can't guarantee you're going to get the ambulance if you call 911. I think we've just looked at the Ivanhoe Hospital recently closing. We hope to work any way we can to assure that if there's one thing you can still get when you dial 911 is the ambulance service. And we continue to lose one or two of them a year. This is an initiative put forward by our Ambulance Association. We have a unique relationship that we ask the regulatory board to help us change these statutes to address some of our staffing needs to allow the first responders to go on the long distance transfers so the EMTs can stay back in communities and hopefully staff another ambulance. Ms. Hedges is right. Some ambulances go over the road from Great Plains to Rochester. They're gone 12 hours, and they may have one ambulance back to cover up to 1,800 square miles of service area with one truck. The first responder portion of it allows that EMT first responder mix to keep it available. So the Ambulance Association wholeheartedly supports this bill and its contents.
For reimbursement for ambulance services, does the service just get reimbursed on the basis of the service as opposed to who's in the truck?
Correct, by the level of care. BLS emergency and advanced life support emergency under the eyes of medical assistance and Medicare get the same exact rate.
And Medicare doesn't have any requirements for who's in the truck?
We were placed on a fee schedule about 6-7 years ago. It hit us for over $100 million of funding this industry received, 7-8 years ago now, and this is the full year of our first inclusion in the fee schedule. So they pay us the same rate, $430.06 flat, and the private insurances will pay what we bill them. So although we can bill an advanced life support rate and a basic life support rate, Medicare and Medicaid are the same rate, but on the other insurance carriers, it's pretty much a flat right across the board.
Okay. And what about first responders who respond to the emergencies and kind of stabilize people before the ambulance arrives? What kind of reimbursement do they get?
Right now, nothing. It's funny you brought that up, Chairman Thiessen. We just had
that discussion
the other day about we're getting more requests to have that happen, and that's something we may look at in the future coming up here at the fire chiefs and the EMS responders. As ambulance services start to close down, there is a large need on our volunteer first responder squads. Most of them are supported by townships, booyah feeds, fundraisers, car washes, to try to keep them afloat, and the number they're looking at is pretty small.
And I just have one other clarifying question on Section 3. So you're saying that's $385,000. That's not changing.
No. That would not change. It would stay level, just how it's distributed.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Representative Liebman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if you could expound a little bit on who are these first responders, and I guess I just wonder if doing this, you know, I mean, obviously, if you're taking a first responder and putting them in this ambulance and having them drive the 12 hours, there's a hole created there as well. Could you just discuss that a little bit, too?
First responders, if you register First Responder Minnesota, you take it's a 40-hour course as opposed to an EMT. Basic is about 110 to 120-hour class. And a lot of people will choose to become first responders rather than EMTs because it's a lot less training and they don't have to pass a pretty difficult national exam associated with the EMT class. Those people... right now, there are first responders on ambulance services working as third or fourth people. Or there are also people that a lot of your law enforcement officers are first responders. A lot of firefighters are first responders. We have about 16,000 registered first responders in Minnesota compared to about 10,000 EMTs. Does that help answer your question?
Yes.
Any other questions, members? Representative Block.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to our guests, not being as familiar with this area, are there some medical conditions that would, I mean, I assume we require 2MT level people as the desirable, since there must be some medical occasions that may arise where both personnel and the ambulance are required to attend to the patient. Is that correct? And are there some risks that we should avoid here in terms of those particularly fragile situations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, we do that every day in the ambulance business. The metro system's mostly staffed with 2 paramedic levels. In the outstate right now, it's usually paramedic EMT and 2 EMTs for our basic life support ambulances. Unless this person is trained to be in the ambulance, a driving class, and familiar with the equipment and on the regulatory board's roster, they usually don't operate the vehicle. So they would be in the back assisting the EMT or the paramedic anyway. So the idea behind this, allowing this happen, it helps the regulatory board and their regional specialists assure that if I'm a first responder in Marshall, Minnesota, I may be driving the ambulance for 2 EMTs that may be in the back with a critical patient.
Any other questions, members? All right. Representative Peterson, this really is a serious issue in rural Minnesota, and we need to, I mean, I'm glad that you've brought this forward, because we do need to get at this issue, and I think this is a good step forward. I think we are going to have to re-refer it to finance. So, unless there's any other questions, I would renew my motion that House File 250 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion is adopted. Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, for your comments and referral.
House File 634, Representative Norton. Representative Norton, go ahead.
Yes, I would like to move House File 634, which is a resolution for adoption today. And I have a statement, and then we'll field questions if that's acceptable.
Go ahead. Thanks.
Okay. Chair Tisa and members, before you is House File 634. It is a resolution urging the Congress to reauthorize the State Children's Health Insurance Program. SCHIP is a partnership between the federal government and the states designed to provide an expansion of health insurance coverage for low-income children under the age of 19 with federal poverty levels of up to 200%. States have flexibility in determining their respective eligibility levels, and Minnesota has moved to add some parents and pregnant women to this program. SCHIP began and was first authorized as part of the Balanced Budget Act of 1997 with $40 billion appropriated over the next 10 years. This program needs to be reauthorized again this year or it will end. Congressional reauthorization of SCHIP is needed to assure continued coverage by Minnesota's SCHIP enrollees. Access to care and preventive medicine can improve overall health and contribute to the reduction of overall health care expenditures. These enrollees are able to obtain care for routine services as well as preventive services such as immunizations, well-child checkups, prenatal care, and annual services such as mammograms. SCHIP has been successful in reducing the number of uninsured low-income children in Minnesota. We currently have over 23,000 Minnesotans receiving health care through their participation in this SCHIP program. There's widespread support for the program, and I believe this resolution before you today is supported by health care professionals, health plans, and children's and public health advocates. Members should also have in their packet a story from Saturday's Star Tribune, and it was a proposal that Representative Jim Ramstead is going to be carrying at the federal level, and hopefully you have that. Mr. Chairman and members, the SCHIP program is a key part of the House File 1, which is Chair Thiessen's bill, to provide all Minnesotan children with health insurance. As Congressman Ramstead notes, Minnesota currently has 73,000 kids without health insurance. Without the reauthorization of SCHIP by Congress, that number will jump. So I thank you for entertaining this resolution and hope I have your support.
Thank you, Representative Norton. Questions for members? Okay. Oh, Representative Trumper, sorry.
Yes. Question on the $60.7 million. How do they come up with that? Do we have to match that? Does Minnesota have to match that, $60.7?
I believe this is a matching program. We get some money from the federal level, and we match it here at the state level. We do have some flexibility on how we spend that money in the state, and as I mentioned, we have made some changes.
And Representative Schumper, I think we get matched at 65% as opposed to 50% on regular Medicaid. So we pay 35%.
Sure. And that'll all be part of the funding for House File 1?
Well, let's hope. We have to get this reauthorized. That's okay. What we're seeking from Congress to do.
And the reauthorization provides the base for the programs that we have in this state.
Right. But my question is this going to cover the same children we're talking about? Is this going to be used as part of covering the children we're talking about with House File 1? What's the relationship between SCHIP and House File 1?
Representative Schumper, I think that's a fair question. Maybe Mr. Representative Norton or Mr. Chung can explain how we're actually not using most of our SCHIP money, as I understand it, really to cover children right now, but to cover parents and other things. But maybe you could discuss exactly how we do it currently.
How the purpose.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumper, I guess regarding House File 1, I'm assuming it depends on how the state files its SCHIP plan. I mean, if the state were to simply renew the current group that it's funding, then those would be the three groups that are listed, you know, at the bottom of the bill summary.
Does that help, Representative Schumper?
I guess so.
Okay. My sense is that if Congress were to reauthorize this or reauthorize it at a higher level or do what Representative Ramstead is saying, that would provide us some more flexibility to do what's happening in House File 1.
Okay. That's,
yes.
I thought they were connected.
Yeah. The only other question I would have, I guess, is whether we could add something in here that would encourage Congress not to penalize us because we're good. Has that been considered at all?
I have not had that discussion with anyone, but certainly if you have some language that would strengthen this, I would welcome it.
Unfortunately, I don't right now, but and we might as well just send it onto the floor. That's fine.
You could make that.
Well, I'll send a letter. How about that?
Okay.
Any other discussion, members? All right, and this is a resolution, members. I don't know if we've handled these resolutions like this as often so much in the past, as opposed to just bringing them right up to the House floor, but I think the thought of leadership is we ought to at least think through the policy first going forward. So this will be sent directly to the floor. So, Representative Norton, do you want to renew your motion?
Yes, Chair Thiessen, thank you. I would renew my motion for approval of House File 634 and to go directly to the floor.
I think it's what, to be placed in the General Register?
Okay. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion is adopted, and House File 634 will go to the General Register. Thank you. Representative Norris, thanks for coming. And I will move House File 625, and that it be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Finance Committee.
Thank you.
Representative Norris.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 625 is a result of a conversation I had with a constituent who called me. The husband in this family had been laid off, and as a consequence of that, also lost his insurance coverage for the family. They were in the process of applying for Minnesota Care, but they had the four-month waiting period, and they were okay with that. But the concern that the mother had was for the kids, for the children. And she wanted to be able to insure them right away without having to wait for that four-month period. And so I thought, I'm not sure why that couldn't happen. It seemed like a perfectly logical thing. If the family is willing to insure their children, I think that's what we all want. And so that's why I introduced this bill, and it's quite simple as far as what it does. And if the children are defined as individuals under the age of 21 in this case. So Mr. Chair, I think that's basically
thank you.
The bill.
No, I appreciate that. I think it's a great bill. Any discussion or questions for members? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Nornes, do you? I asked Representative Murphy this, so I think it's only fair that I ask you as well.
Sure.
On a different bill. Do you know how many children are expected to be drawn into Minnesota Care through your proposal? I think it's important for us to understand the magnitude of what we're trying to do how many kids that we're expecting to cover under your proposal.
Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, I don't have a specific number. I only know one family right now that's interested in doing this. And again, this is something the family would do. It's not something they're asking the state to do for them. So they will pay the premium. They will cover the cost. And how many families that would impact, I truly do not know. I know there are uninsured children, and that's one of the aims of this legislature, at least one of the topics we talk about a lot, is to insure them. This is not asking the state to do that. This is simply allowing the family themselves to provide the coverage.
Representative Brown, I have that number upstairs. I would I'm almost sure. And it strikes me that somewhere in the under 10,000 kids, 5,000 kids, somewhere in that range. So, but I'll try to get that to you.
Mr. Chair, I assume the number would be for those that are applying for Minnesota Care right now, the families that are waiting that 4 months. If you knew that number, then you'd probably know the number of potential children if you had one or two per household or something.
President Brown.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would appreciate if you have that information. I would love to see it. I imagine that it will be taken into account as the fiscal note is prepared on this as well. So thank you, Representative Norris and Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You answered what I was going to say.
Is that about right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Representative Sotwell, sorry.
It's been a long day. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would speak in support of this bill, but I am recalling a conversation we had at one point about the uninsured. We keep talking about the 73,000 uninsured, and I think we all share the goal of getting them insured or get them with coverage, whether it be a public program or a private program. But I think it would be helpful for us to hear what goes into that 73,000, how many are currently eligible for programs, for example, and maybe even some analysis either from the department or others about why they're, if they're eligible, why are they not on current public programs. I would find that very interesting as we're trying to make these policy decisions that are kind of driven by a desire to get the 73,000 kids covered. because I think we share the goal. It's just that I think it's important to understand that, to know the best way for us to do that.
And Representative Gottwell, I think that's true. And we did have a little bit of discussion on that. I think it's about 50-50 that are a year longer and a year less, if I recall from the report the department did. You know, I think one of the things in this four-month requirement, one of the purposes of this is to kind of avoid some of the bleed from the private market into the public market. I'm not sure how that applies to children as opposed to adults making, you know, that decision as well, but it's a very point well taken. And I think that report that you referenced gives some pretty good background on that. Representative Bunn.
To that point you just raised, Mr. Chair and Representative Norris, in terms of the particular case that you're familiar with and your discussions with them, did they give an explanation as to whether they pursued some private insurance market coverage for their children or for all of them in this interim period while they're unemployed? And if so, did they determine that the Minnesota Care premiums were just going to be much more affordable for them to cover their children than anything else that they could find in the market? Or what kind of information did they have when seeking the Minnesota Care coverage?
Representative Norris.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn, is that correct? All I was told at the time was that, again, the father had lost his job, and so the income was dramatically changed for the family. They didn't talk about going out to find other insurance because they simply couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. They knew, and they were positive that they met all the requirements to be on Minnesota Care, but had to wait the 4 months themselves. And I understand the reason for that. I just couldn't come up with a way to justify why the parents were, they were very interested in keeping their children safe. And that was their primary focus.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nornis, I do thank you also for bringing this bill forward. Besides the stated reasons to support this, I think one of the other groups of individuals that come to mind, and I'll use a particular profession in healthcare, whether it is our nurses, our home health aides, and things of that nature that actually transition from job to job quite a bit, that they may end up in a lapse of being able to get health care from their new provider, or may not be able to afford the new provider, their new company's health insurance, and their family, their entire family, including their children, end up going months without being able to qualify for Minnesota Care. And so anything that we can do to lessen the amount of children that are uninsured and making sure that families are whole, I think it's important for not just this committee, but this body to figure out how we're going to make that happen.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norris, I take it that the husband and father of this family was the sole provider of the family and that she did not work at all. Is that correct?
I didn't specifically ask that question, but I got, that's the impression I got from the chance.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, do you know if the husband was offered COBRA as an alternative for health care?
Representative Norris?
I do not know. I did ask about his reemployment opportunities, and that may happen where he gets another job. That's probably what everybody would hope for. He was a car salesman, and his job didn't work out. So,
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norris, I just wanted to thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's a worthy discussion. And I especially wanted to thank you for bringing something forward on behalf of your constituent who's concerned about taking care of his family. Thank you.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't pass up the opportunity when Representative Anderson brought up COBRA, and that's an important part of our health care market. But if you're an individual or a family that's just lost all your income and you're in the process of searching, and you may even pick up a part-time or a contract or things of that nature, COBRA's not going to help you. There's no way in the world that you're going to be able to afford most COBRA plans.
Representative Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, I think this is a great debate as we try to figure out how on earth do we get people covered in what form. And I think just following up on Representative Gottwalt's comments, and I think just in regards to Representative Walker's comments too, you know, I mean, we want people covered. There's no doubt about that. But the question is how. And I look at the situation that Representative Nornes has brought forward to us, and I say, well, gosh, isn't this a great argument for private coverage in a portable manner? You know, the coverage travels with people. They don't have to be tied down to a job. If you look at who's creating jobs in the state of Minnesota and throughout the nation, it's small businesses. People are not staying in the jobs as long as they once were. And so, you know, whether it's a health savings account or whether it's some other type of portable insurance, I hope that this committee will really take a strong look at that while we also are looking at what components should government play, should government not play. And I just wanted to take the opportunity to kind of put that back on the table.
Thank you, Representative Broad. And I think, I think portability is important. I also, it sounds from the situation Representative Nornes's constituent is that they don't have a job and are making no money. So I'm not sure how they'd pay for the private health care option, even if it was portable. But it is a worthwhile discussion to have. Any further discussion, members? Okay. Well, thank you, Representative Nornes. I will renew my motion that House File 625 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Nornes. Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 475 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Commerce Committee.
That's right. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill addresses a situation that is encountered by an increasing number of young people as they merge into adult life, and that our current law right now provides that a parent can cover under their dependent health insurance policy any dependent who is a full-time student under age 25 or a disabled student if they are taking a part-time load due to that disability. This bill proposes that we eliminate the requirement that they be a full-time post-secondary student. The situation currently arises, and it's very difficult to enforce by the health plans until, of course, you have that car accident and then somebody's trying to figure out who to pay, where students are taking an internship. That's oftentimes the key to getting a job post-employment, and an internship typically doesn't give you a full load of credit for that period of time when you're getting work experience, and so they lose their health insurance during that period of time. Or they need to take a double major, and their last semester they're taking less than a full-time load just because that's all they need to complete that second major. Or they may be in a situation where there are gaps after graduating from college before they get that first job. My district is home to a lot of university students, and when I was door knocking this fall, I discovered a lot of them who had graduated with bright, shiny new diplomas, but no employment except that part-time job that was getting them through college. And usually they've added another part-time job on, both of which wouldn't provide insurance coverage. They'd still have to meet the requirement of dependence, so they would still have to be dependent on their family for half of their support. So this will not be picking up those people who are successfully employed full-time, have access to insurance, and have established themselves independently. And I think it's a good public policy because, first of all, it helps us reduce the number of uninsured people. We know that when people are uninsured, they get into car accidents, they have sudden illnesses, and they contribute to our uncompensated care, which we all pick up in higher health insurance premiums. It promotes continuity of care because people do run into those gaps as they're launching their adult life, and this allows them to retain a relationship with those providers. It helps them establish adult habits and relationships with care providers in their community. And for some, it can help lower the cost of higher education. Some of our post-secondary schools actually require uninsured students to contribute to insurance. I've been told that it's over $700 a semester at the University of Minnesota if you can't prove that you have insurance coverage in another way. So I think the benefits of this would certainly help us in a variety of issues that we as a committee have addressed. We did adopt this earlier as part of a consideration of House File 1. And I can tell you that I have been contacted by health plans, provider representatives, and you have a letter in your packet from NAMI, the National Association for Persons with Mental Illness, who support this. As you know, many people, as they're emerging into that adult life, that's when serious challenges related to mental health issues, chemical dependency, and other issues start to emerge. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll take questions.
Questions, members, for the author? Representative Norton.
Chair Thiessen, members. I just want to be clear, and then I think I have a question for you. What this does is change a provision that dealt with students to having nothing to do with school that simply says any child that lives at home till 25 and is dependent on their parents gets insurance or could get insurance.
Representative Lothar.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Norton, almost. It's that they are a dependent child, so they may or may not live at home in that situation of dependency.
Okay, but they may or may not be they may or may not be a student. This takes out the whole provision of students. And I guess I'm struggling with this a little bit. The question I would have to follow up, and I understand the intent, and as we talk about healthcare in the bigger picture, I become far more comfortable. I just don't think we're there yet. Can a family currently get a rider for the, because this is about private insurance as I'm reading this. Can a family currently buy a rider for their child or an adult policy for a child, say after age 21 or 18 or 19, and cover them that way already?
Representative Laffa.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, I suspect that you could find an insurance agent that would issue a policy. I think it's hard to find those kind of gap coverage policies when you have that one quarter or semester while you're doing an internship or in that unknown period before you find that first job after you've graduated. So I think this tries to address some of those challenges, and I think it also tries to, I don't know that you would be able to ensure that you'd still be able to see the same providers, and part of the value of this would be to allow continuity of care during those periods.
And I appreciate that, and you know, I have four children, and they've had various stages of uninsured and insured in their 18 to 26 year, you know, time frame, so I appreciate what you're trying to do. I'm still... The situation you just described was, again, about a student. And yet this policy isn't about students any longer. And, in fact, the example of the letter that you gave about NAMI and how this is, you have a letter of support, which I'll have to read because I didn't see it in here, and I apologize for that. I'll borrow one. Thank you. Is driving home the fact that this is not about students any longer. It's just about extending who we can call a family, a coverable family member in the current private care policies. And so, again, I'm still getting back to, I don't know the insurance industry's requirements, but I would assume that if I choose to insure my 21-year-old, my 26-year-old, that they would allow me to do that already. And it, so I'm just struggling with why, what this bill is going to do other than take out the word student.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, this is still, first of all, remember that this is only for dependent children, so this is not for liberated children. And in the instance of a child with an adult child with a disability that could be mental health issues, they would be covered, as I understand it right now, under existing law, under lines 1.16 and 1.17 of the bill, which allows a dependent to include a child who's disabled who meets a disability definition. So this would be more in the situation of, for example, if someone were, in the case of someone who was challenged by mental health issues, perhaps someone ran into, it's not a young person in college has a bout of depression. And maybe their provider would say, I think you should take the next semester off while you're adjusting to medications or therapy or whatever, and we think it can stabilize you so you can continue on successfully. I would think that this would be the kind of coverage that would assist in that process, where otherwise they would potentially be thrown into MCHA, because at the point you have a pre-existing condition, it becomes much more difficult than to get a private policy to cover during that period of time. this would allow for continuity of that care during that period.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, I also have some concerns like Representative Norton, but I really appreciate what you are trying to do here. I mean, this is an age group that it tends to be uninsured, and that is a problem for a lot of people. But I just wonder if under your bill, the remaining requirement for people in this age group is that they be dependent, whether that in fact encourages kids in this age group to be dependent. Maybe I'm expressing this concern because I'm a parent of children moving into that age group, but have you thought about that? I mean, you know,
he will still be with.
Okay, well, but you know what I mean. If you have to be dependent in order to have health coverage, doesn't that say, well, Mom, let me stay home and not get that job?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, I hesitate to speak as someone who is not the parent of someone in this age group, but from what I know of young people, the incentive of being covered by health insurance is not the main driver for a choice to pursue or not pursue a more self-supporting lifestyle.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, I can tell you I have tried, since my son was little, to plan to prepare him to leave the house. And his ideal dream would be a side-by-side where the door really connected to my refrigerator. So, I mean, that, you know, it doesn't really matter what you do in every case and how you prepare them. Representative Loeffler, I thank you for this bill. You know, regardless of if this is a bill or if we should be looking at something slightly different, I think this is moving in the direction that we should be having. You have different situations. I have many constituents that would benefit from this, but I will talk from even myself personally. You have the students that graduate high school and are not ready to go to college, but if you left it up to them, they would not be buying health care insurance. Their parent would buy health care insurance, and not all of the plans allow for that exemption once your child's not considered a full-time student. My son, for example, is taking classes off. He didn't have all the classes, weren't available. So we struggled with, do you go part-time? And he was like, well, Mom, why would I pay part-time if you're not going to be capable to cover me anyway? So if you're going to cover me, we might as well spend that extra money, and I won't take any classes till the fall, which is a down part, because I'm like, oh, we need to hurry up and get you out. And, you know, so I think that there are many different circumstances that families find themselves in for whatever reason. We have a lot of young people that are going into professions, thankfully, that they may not be able to work a full-time job once they graduate for a whole year, or their income may not be able to get up to a livable wage for a particular year, that they are going to be able to have to lean on their parents a little longer than their parents anticipated. And we want these young people going into these professions, in particular in our healthcare professions, that they will not be making a lot of money right away. And so, but we still want them insured, and this isn't necessarily the first thing that they think about when they are moving out into the world and making sure. You know, my son, you know, he's like, I never get sick and I'll be fine, Mom. And I'm like, as soon as you get sick, I'm going to pay the bill. And, you know, not every single family can afford to have their parents pay that bill. Some individual families, that bill would fall upon that young person. And then we get into uncompensated care and moving on into our other health care dilemmas that we have. So I thank you. Look forward to watching this bill move forward and other ideas that members may have, and how do we get to where your intent is trying to go.
Thank you, Representative Walker. Representative Otremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to talk a little bit about a case that I'm working on right now. She's a student. She's a nursing student, and she broke her ankle, and so she was not able to finish her clinical. So she's now not having enough credits to qualify for her health insurance. To double that, she will now always be behind in her clinical. So she will always be short of credits until graduation. Her parents are just, what are we going to do? And she doesn't know what to do.
because they are not in a position where they can pay that extra health care. And those are not uncommon situations. She's a 4.0 and can't get a full load because she will never catch up with her clinical because they're only offered in certain semesters.
President Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Otremba's point, I'm wondering, maybe Mr. Chun could tell me this. I understand under existing state law that there are exceptions for people with disabilities who carry a lower course load as a result of a disability. Now maybe the broken ankle doesn't qualify, but...
Well, Mr. Chair, we think it doesn't qualify, but she may qualify for this semester. But she won't qualify for all those other semesters where she's going to be 4 credits behind until she graduates from college.
Okay. Well, my reason for raising my hand is I've got 5 kids, and I'm not imagining I've got a refrigerator big enough for them. So outside of that disincentive, I do have a genuine concern about the disincentive for people to, young people in particular, to get involved in education, because right now that mandate that they carry a course load is an incentive for young people to move into an educational setting and not simply coast, if you will, and not that all of them are in that situation. The final concern I have is what this would do to family insurance premiums. As somebody who insures a family of 7 myself, what would this do actuarially to family insurance premiums across the board? And would we, in fact, price some people out of family insurance and force, you know what I mean, some of the unintended consequences of this sort of move? I'm wondering if that's been considered at all, Representative Loeffler, and if anybody with an actuarial background could comment on
that. Well, Representative Loeffler, you can speak to that. And I would also like to have someone from the plans come up and address that issue.
That'd be great. Mr. Chairman, and to Representative Altman, while they're coming up, the one thing I have heard and we can have them address is that at least for group policies, having more of these young, generally healthy people in the pool actually helps better enrich the pool in terms of its balance of healthy versus unhealthy lives. So in a group situation, it actually enhances the pool. If you're purchasing an individual family policy, which, you know, less people do, I'm not sure. And if we're not able to address it today, we certainly will in the Commerce Committee.
Thank you. And Ms. Coleman, yes, that would be great. Thank you. You're the designee, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jeanette Coleman, and I'm with Medica. The question as far as how would this impact the premiums for the family coverage is going to vary a little bit depending on if we're talking about a large employer or a small employer. So in the small employer market, you can have in the large employer, you can have individual plus one, and family. And typically family, if you have 1 child or 4 children, it's the same premium. In the small employer market, it's a little bit different. You can have individual and individual plus one, and then each dependent after that, typically up to 3, is an additional premium. And that's a premium amount that's specific for a dependent, and that's a lower premium amount. So you could have, if you had over 3 children, which I have 3, I can't imagine more, but if you had over 3 children, those additional dependents after that would not add any additional premium. But if you had 2 and you add a 3rd, there would be an additional dependent premium added. Does that answer the question?
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does a little bit, but I'm also thinking if we're adding another age group, if we're allowing people at a greater age to be part of their family's policy without the education requirement, we're talking about adding more people and having to cover more health care costs.
Ms. Coleman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, you know, that is something that, as we looked at this, there are aspects of this proposal that are more of an issue as to whether or not the small employers think that this would create a problem for them. As we looked at this, as health plans, you know, we support what Representative Loeffler is trying to achieve with this in creating more opportunities for people to be insured. There's also the administrative aspect of this that there's some savings. All of the health plans spend a lot of effort verifying student status. And our members don't like that because we send letters quite often, twice a year on this, and if you know, a lot of people don't open their mail that they get from us, and so we have to hold play. I don't know why. But so it does sometimes create a lot of problems with individuals who have to do a lot of back work then first. So this would take away that administrative burden of having to verify student status as well.
Thank you. And Ms. Coleman, just on this issue of the pool, I mean, Representative Loeffler, I think, referred to this with regard to this population being a healthier population. I mean, would that have an effect on premiums overall?
It would. And this is a population, as Representative Loeffler suggested, is a healthier population. It's also, if you look at the rate of the uninsured, this is one of the highest areas of the uninsured from an age group. And the reason is, they are healthy. Health insurance is expensive. They're invincible because of the age that they are. And so, you know, I'd rather buy CDs than pay for premium insurance. And so that's the other piece of it that's working. So for the most part, you are adding a healthier population actuarially. And so it shouldn't have as much of an impact if this was a demographic that was a more expensive population.
And one other question on the individual for the small employers. Representative Loeffler, maybe you can add, this would not require a family to actually insure. Well, how would that work? I suppose, would you be required to insure someone? I mean, I would think in the large employer you'd have no choice because you get the dependent coverage or not. But to add another individual, you wouldn't necessarily have to do that as a family for the small employer market, right?
Mr. Chairman and members, that's my understanding, is it would still be that individual family's choice as to whether or not to include that person in as an additional dependent.
But
in a plan that you had to pay per dependent.
But on the larger employer market then, where you insure a family, this actually may increase the family rate. So maybe that's what Representative Gottwald was getting at, because you're adding people into that larger family rate.
It potentially, I think that the we don't really have any way of knowing for sure how many people would move into this as a result of this. Certainly if it seemed that there were significant increases in the number of people then that were covered on family, the actuaries may take a look at this and it may impact pricing. Our initial look at it, however, is that we don't expect the numbers to be large enough to impact the premium pricing for family coverage.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's helpful. Representative Broad, did you have a question on this?
Well, actually, that kind of got a little closer to what I was looking at, Ms. Coleman. Sorry. So if I heard you correctly, I heard you say a couple things. Is that you guys actually have looked at the actual actuarial, you know, we need to change that word.
I know what
that's actuarial studies. And you've come to the conclusion that but for a huge influx, you don't see an increase in the premiums, and I'm not talking about those who wish to add for their own family, but say I already have something in place with your company, I do nothing. If we change this law, a group of people come in, what will happen to me?
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, we have not, and perhaps one of the other health plans perhaps have, but you know, we haven't done a formal actuarial study to determine is this going to drive up our family rates on large employers. The discussions that have taken place is that we don't believe that there are that many enough children that would impact that. I mean, remember, you know, at Medica, we have 1.3 million members. And so to impact those rates, it would take more than a couple hundred kids even coming into the impact the rates. But I want to make it clear, we haven't formally done that, but I can guarantee you that it would not have an impact. We just don't believe it will.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Coleman, how about, you know, we talked about large employers, small employers. How about individuals?
Individuals are not sold as family coverage with that, so this just wouldn't be relevant to the individual market.
Perfect. And then, Mr. Chairman,
one
more question, but maybe I'll actually defer if there's other questions for Ms. Coleman, because mine are for Representative Loeffler.
Any other questions for Ms. Coleman? I have some other people on the list, but okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you continue? Oh. Representative Roth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I said Representative Loeffler, but maybe we'll start with Mr. Chun. I'm looking through the bill, and being a little newer to this area than others, I look on lines 1.2, and we talk about young adults, and then I look on lines 1.3, and we talk about full-time students, and then I go down to lines 1.8, and we talked about unmarried children. I'm interested that we allow children to marry. Mm-hmm. And then we have something with 19, age 19, age 25. I'm just wondering how many definitions of child we have out there, what the rationale for these definitions are. And, Mr. Chairman, I think I started thinking about this actually when I saw the unmarried child definition in the amendment that you put on your bill as well. And I'm just somewhat curious on how we got to this point.
Mr. Chun?
Mr. Chair, that's the thought. I guess I'm not sure either, and actually that's maybe a better question for our insurance analyst who will be, you know, staffing the next committee. He's actually the one who's actually covered this bill.
Representative Brock.
Mr. Chairman, fair enough. I think that maybe we should talk with Mr. Pender about that a little bit as well. I'm just, you know, it's just kind of striking when you have five different definitions, four different definitions, all in play on the same issue. And so it seems like maybe this is an opportunity for us to streamline government, to streamline definitions, and maybe there's rationale. I'm just trying to understand it.
And Representative Brock, I mean, some of it I think is probably driven by what the federal Medicaid will match, and they'll match some up to 19 and some up to 21, and so various, and then the tax code for this one as well. So I think some of it's driven by federal law, but fair enough. Representative Anderson.
My question's been answered. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. I actually worked on this bill a couple of years ago, and I'm glad it's getting further than I could get it then. And I think this kind of fits the theme. What we're trying to do is to get more people into plans. And this is especially, I think, a valuable way to do it. These are people that already have coverage, and if they have to pay more, they will. They're happy to help their child be covered a bit more if they have to pay something. Having four kids at home, so this is a great bill for me. So two are off on their own, and you're right, they're invincible. They're fine, you know. But also, it just occurred to me that maybe this would reduce some of the burden on Minnesota Care, because some of these, progeny of people who are parents—that's another definition—would be in the Minnesota Care category under 175% of poverty. I'd probably, and so we're paying one way or the other. And so I think as we attempt to make that Minnesota Care be the right size to cover the people that need it, this is another positive way. So I hope it passes.
Representative Norton.
Chair Thiessen, members. I'm still struggling a little bit, and I'll just tell you why I'm struggling, and then I'll probably vote against it in hopes that this will be handled in the House File 1 or some other means. I could support this totally if it was full or part-time student, and I totally respect the having had a child last semester who was part-time and wasn't insured, and the example could be my own that you gave. Representative Otermba, so I'm living that experience, and she did end up in the emergency room and have to go through the MA papers and all that because she is uninsured. So I totally understand this, and I think the full or part-time student, if we could have had that language rather than covering anybody up till age 25. And I would think the other piece I'm really struggling with is going to 25, to me, might encourage a little bit too much a lack of moving on, going to school. So if it was a student in 21, full or part-time student in 21, I could probably cover this. So I guess I am supportive of the effort, and I think our larger bills need to deal with these students and other uninsured individuals like my part-time college student who does need insurance. And I just am not comfortable with this bill as it's written. So, but I appreciate all the work, and hopefully we'll get to the end of it before the end of session.
Representative Loeffler.
Sure. Mr. Chairman and Representative, I respect your thinking, but I have to say that would, if we did it just to full or part-time students, it doesn't deal with the situation that Representative Otremba brought forward. If someone breaks a leg and has to drop out, they cannot get to class, they can't maneuver through, or the person who is diagnosed with perhaps depression and is encouraged to drop out for a period of time to stabilize. And, you know, so my goal is to deal with that. And while I wish
that we had a higher education system that did as it was envisioned, that every child graduates after 4 years and then completes their master's in less than two. The reality is that it's almost amazing to me how 5 and 6 years have become more average than not for people completing an extended post-secondary experience. And I think that that is why that particular year was selected. It was also to cover people who are pursuing advanced degrees and as well as undergraduate degrees. But the reality is that students' populations right now, even if they're going full-time, are less likely to complete in 4 years than was perhaps true even 10 years ago.
And if I could just redirect, I'm not an attorney, but on the back page of the House research piece we got, it's a piece about repeals. As I understood this, it does say for full-time students, and again, I'm fine with full and part-time students, it said who cannot carry a full-time course load due to illness, injury, or physical or mental disability, and I thought that language, as well as the language on line 1.17, address some of those other issues. So that's why I was not dealing with that piece of that you just explained very well, and I appreciate that. I thought that dealt with it, so thanks. I may be in error there.
Mr. Chairman, the one other thing I'd like to mention is that I know there's been a lot of debate, and it will continue on, about how much of our health care dollars go into administration. And, you know, this is one of those examples of where we're asking them to constantly verify, constantly have a system in place to check up on the kids, and, you know, every little bit of that adds up and distracts from the dollars that are actually going to curing people and taking care of their health.
President Buck.
Yes, Chair Thiessen and Representative Loeffler. I have kind of a point of clarification and then a comment and a question. A clarification, when you say dependent means that half the support has to be coming from the parents still, is that also for the purposes of your state and federal taxes what it means to be a dependent?
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, I will not pretend to be an expert on tax law, and I don't know if Mr. Chun can either, but...
First, on the comment side, I was quite amazed while door knocking this past year how frequently this came up. I'm from a district that's fairly well-to-do. It's one of the wealthiest counties in the state, and hearing from middle-class and upper-middle-class families gaps in care for their kids under 25 or under 26, either in the college years or immediately after, that they graduated from college in June, and it was now August, and they had, you know, it was going to be a while before they found that full-time job or found a job, period, that they were still searching, and the parents were struggling to find them some kind of gap coverage for them, for those kinds of issues. So it was a very frequently mentioned topic. And also, many of those parents mentioned their children going on Minnesota Care or them encouraging them to go on Minnesota Care. So this issue of the shift to Minnesota Care of some of these young people is also there. And so I think this would be a plus in that regard. I raised the question about the definition of dependent because I'm not uncomfortable with this issue of opening it to non-students, although I definitely want to encourage the enroll in school, is that as with whether your child remains in your home after 18 years old or gets to drive your car or eat your food, it will be your decision as a parent to keep them on your plan, add them to your plan, or pay for this coverage. I assume you can confirm or deny that, but this is a parental family decision still about whether you're going to extend this to your child. So whether they continue to be dependent really is a choice decision of us as parents and not strictly a function of this legislation imposing some further dependency on us, and that we have to make those decisions as we do in all those other areas about the right time to let our children set them free. So I assume that we can address that in that way. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pun. Actually, so the definition of dependent is not tied to the tax code. It's just, is that correct?
I will, Mr. Chairman, I defer to our counsel. There's so many definitions of dependent, as there are, perhaps as many as there are of child.
Mr. Chair, I think it would depend, but I don't have those statutes open, but they're defined. They're referring to the federal law and what federal law requires as a dependent for purpose of the health plans.
Right.
So again, it's something I don't know.
Okay. President Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Bunn, my concern is as a parent, you're right, I would have that ability to make that decision to put them on. One of my concerns is, and I think Ms. Coleman addressed it to some extent, is if I'm not that parent, I'm somebody else, just happen to be in the same market as that parent, what is that doing to my premiums? Are my premiums going up, therefore maybe pushing me off my affordability factors for nothing that I did other than having an extension of the market? And so that's one of my concerns is how are these little important, but how are these things that we're doing not only individually affecting things, but cumulatively affecting things? We passed onto the House floor the House File 111. We heard testimony, or I've gotten information that has the potential to increase premium costs for some members, 2 to 4% is some numbers that have been throwing around. And so my concern is what are we doing to premiums and making sure that we as a committee are looking at these things not only individually, but how are they stacking up together? If we pass House File 111, how is that stacking up with this, and how is that increasing costs overall in terms of pushing people off their ability to afford private insurance? So that's kind of something that I'm looking at on an overall basis.
Representative Bunn.
Chair Keeson and Representative Broad, just one comment in response. I think there's two separate issues. One I was raising is that one. I acknowledge the importance of discussing the issue you've raised as well. I would just say in regard to that issue, though, in particular, that I kind of look at cost overall in the entire system. And these individuals are going to currently go uninsured for a period of time or under a certain age. We're either going to be experiencing them on Minnesota Care, as I indicated, some of them are signed for Minnesota Care, or they're ending up in that uncompensated care in our medical system. And we're all paying through our private premiums in the system as that uncompensated care goes into our private premiums. So I think overall, I would think most likely getting them actually covered in some way and avoiding those shifts in Minnesota Care or the uncompensated care to our premiums for that avenue most likely would be a lower cost option overall in the system than an increased cost option.
Mr. Chairman, I tend to think Representative Broad is correct. I think over time it has a chance to reconfigure the premium structure a little bit, but I still think it's a really good idea. And frankly, I think probably the worst thing that's going to happen is that people will fudge a little bit more on the definition of dependents with their kids. I mean, you know, who checks that out? How's anybody going to check that out? So, I think that.
Any further discussion, members? This is the danger of going last, having a lot of time left.
Yeah. So.
Okay. I actually thought it was a good discussion, though, so thank you. All right. If there's no further discussion, Representative Lofford will renew her motion that House File 475 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is passed. And members, just an announcement, just to anticipate for next week, we're going to do a lot of long-term care bills, but I understand, I think Representative Walker is going to, on Friday, move out one of the mental health bills, and so we will address that report from that division on Tuesday, but my sense is there's a lot in it, including on education and on a whole variety of issues. But my sense from this committee's perspective, the healthcare stuff really all relates to mental health care, and so I don't anticipate having a discussion in this committee on that because I think the work that was done in mental health division focused on those issues. So that I just want to let members know, though, that's coming. And if you talk to Jen if you want to see the bill. All right, with that, we're adjourned.